Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. We're talking today about Harriet Tubman, a woman who escaped slavery to become an abolitionist, a spy for the Union Army during the Civil War, an activist for women's suffrage, and most famously, a conductor on the Underground Railroad. Every grade school kid, especially in Maryland, has heard of Harriet Tubman, but she's achieved such a mythical stature that we sometimes forget there was a flesh and blood woman at the core of all these stories. Today we're going to talk about that Harriet Tubman. This coming weekend, the annual Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Conference will draw researchers from all over the country to Maryland's Eastern Shore. Tubman's story began there. She was born the child of slaves in Dorchester County in an area called Peter's Neck. She came to know the landscape there intimately, first as a slave and then as an escapee who led dozens of others to freedom through its woods and waterways. The locals have kept her memory alive over the years with a museum and a community-based organization dedicated to her memory. The rest of the country is now catching up. The Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Byway, 125 miles long, was unveiled in 2013. A national monument was dedicated in 2014, and Tubman will soon grace the $20 bill. A Harriet Tubman State Park and Visitor Center will be completed early next year. Plus, HBO is creating a film adaptation of the book Bound for the Promised Land, Harriet Tubman, Portrait of an American Hero. The author of that book is Kate Clifford Larson. She's joining us today from a studio in Melrose, Massachusetts. Kate Larson is consulting historian for both the State Park and the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Byway, and she'll be presenting at this weekend's Underground Railroad Conference in Cambridge, Maryland. Kate Clifford Lawson, so glad you could be with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very, very, very much looking forward to talking with you. What do you think is fueling this flurry of interest in Harriet Tubman?
Well, I think it's been building for a very long time. And then I believe that, you know, everything has its time and its moment. The nation is beginning to come to terms with our historical past about slavery. The success of films like 12 Years a Slave attest to that. The re-release of Roots this weekend. Black Lives Matter. All these things are coming together. It's like a confluence of events. And Harriet Tubman, who's always been in many people's mind, and she's been celebrated by many people for a long time, she just seemed like the right person to come out of, you know, the collection of lots of historical characters that really seems to speak to many of us. And her story is remarkable, and I think we all like to have remarkable stories to look to and to emulate.
You mentioned Black Lives Matter. What do you think Harriet Tubman, how does Harriet Tubman's story speak to that movement?
Well, I think Harriet Tubman, throughout her life, tried to remind people that Black Lives Matter. And she struggled for not only her own freedom, but freedom for others, inequality and justice, self-determination, just like people today who are marching with and advocating for the Black Lives Matters movement. And so she would be there right in the front lines of the movement. I know that she would be. This story has been going on for a very long time in this country, and she would recognize some of the people that participate in that movement as similar to people that she worked with back in the 1800s.
You make such a strong case for why we're so interested in her right now that I'm kind of now struck by the reverse. You write that for many years during the past century, in the 20th century, on the Eastern Shore, Annie Oakley, the marksman, the markswoman who did some shooting on the Eastern Shore, and James Michener with his novel Chesapeake got more attention than Harriet Tubman. Why do you think that was?
I think it's just part and parcel of our historical memory that was erased after the Civil War. you know, the story of what Africans and African Americans endured here in this country was sort of just obliterated. And people moved on, and great white men wrote great white history, and the stories of everyday people, particularly African Americans and other people of color, were just forgotten. So, you know, when Annie Oakley, you know, deserves to be memorialized, and Michener's book Chesapeake is remarkable. But Tubman also tells an incredibly important story about our historical past and our struggle for freedom and equality. And frankly, I think there are very few people in our past that represent it better than Harriet Tubman.
What's your favorite Harriet Tubman story?
Oh, that's so hard. That's not fair to ask.
It is not fair. I'll ask. Maybe I'll ask you later in the hour.
Okay.
Let me ask you this instead. How did you get pulled into Harriet Tubman's story?
I had decided to leave a job in the investment banking field to go back to school and get a master's degree in women's history. And within a few weeks of starting my courses at Simmons College in Boston, my daughter came home with one of those children's biographies of Tubman. She was in second grade. That's when they start with these great American hero biographies. And I read it with her. And even though I had been aware of Harriet Tubman, I just was struck by her story. And I went to the library to look for an adult biography. And the only two that I found were was one that was written in the 19th century and another one in 1943. So it had been 50 years since someone had written about her or done any research on her life. And I was stunned. So I started researching her life and I got hooked, like, you know, really quickly, and fell deeply in love with Harriet Tubman.
What hooked you?
I went, there was just something remarkable about her, her resilience, her determination, that she just wouldn't take no for an answer. She stood on firm ground and demanded that people act and do something right. And I just admired her. And she came from nothing. I mean, she came from the worst background possible, the most disadvantaged background. And she moved on and made people pay attention. She changed people's lives. And I don't know anyone who can't be inspired by that.
Let's pick up on that background. She was the daughter of slaves, owned, I guess by the time they married, they were owned by the same master, correct? But they had been owned by different masters.
They had been owned by different masters who married, and then Tubman's mother, who was owned by Mary Brodus Thompson, died. And so her second husband, Anthony Thompson, took control of Harriet's mother, Writ, but he did not own her. Because of inheritance laws, Writ and her children would go to her son, Edward Brodus.
And one of the things that I learned from your writings is that Writ Green, Harriet Tubman's mother, had been promised her freedom when she reached the age of 45.
Right, right.
Tell us that story.
And she was, well, the man that she had first, she had been born enslaved to Athol Patterson. When he wrote his will, he said that all of his enslaved people would be set free at the age of 45. And then through various inheritances, his great-grandson, Edward Brodus, inherited Writ. And when Writ turned 45, Edward Brodus did not liberate her. He did not set her free, and he should have. And that wasn't necessarily uncommon. You know, people forget, it's wishful thinking not to set someone free. But Harriet Tubman found out the truth. She paid a lawyer $5 when she was about 25 years old to research the will of this man to find out the truth about her mother. And she discovered that her mother should have been set free. And that is just, I can't imagine how Tubman's mother felt when she got that news.
And Tubman knew that the same provision should apply to her, that she should be free legally when she was turned 45, and she could pretty much assume that wasn't going to happen.
That's right. And also her two brothers, Henry and Moses, her youngest brothers, were born free because Writ was about 45 or 46 when those two boys were born. She was in her late 40s.
Ah.
So they should have been born free. and they were not. They were kept enslaved.
So even by the twisted laws of the time, they were not being treated fairly. This is Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm talking about Harriet Tubman with her biographer, Kate Clifford Lawson. What would you like to know about Harriet Tubman? You can be part of this conversation if you call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email to midday@wypr.org. Kate Clifford Lawson, some of the things we think we know about Harriet Tubman turn out not to be true, and you have tracked down the truth. What are some of the most persistent myths?
Well, the big one is that she rescued 300 people in 19 trips, when in fact she rescued about 70 family members and friends in about 13 trips. Sarah Bradford was a 19th century biographer who wrote that first book about Tubman, and she made up those numbers about 300 people in 19 trips. Now, the fewer numbers doesn't mean that Tubman still isn't great. She is, because virtually nobody went back after running away to get other people. It was so rare. And for someone like Tubman, who was so petite and tiny and with no real, you know, she was illiterate and with no skills, she was able to go back that many times to rescue people is remarkable. She also gave information and instructions to about 70 more who found freedom on their own using her directions and her contacts along the Underground Railroad route to the north. So, you know, I don't want people to be disappointed with that. They shouldn't be, because she still stands tall in the annals of the Underground Railroad.
So that is one of the myths. What are some other myths that you think people need to be corrected about?
She also only went to Maryland and only went to the Eastern Shore to rescue people that she knew and loved. She did not go to Alabama or Georgia, Mississippi, or any other southern state. And that's another bit of misinformation, that people think that she was all over the place. They also think that she invented the Underground Railroad, and that's not true. It had been operating very successfully for decades, or, you know, 100 years before Tubman tapped into an existing network near where she lived. So those are just a couple of the more myths that, you know, we've tried to overturn. Another one is that there was a $40,000 reward for her capture, and that absolutely is not true. The only reward was $100 for her return after she ran away with her brothers the first time. And then after that, there were no other rewards. They did not know. Nobody knew that it was tiny, petite Harriet Tubman who was going back and rescuing people and bringing them away. It just wasn't something that people knew or understood or even imagined.
I want to ask you, I've got lots more questions, and our listeners do too. And that one in particular, I want to pick up on when we come back. We have to take a quick break here. Kate Clifford Lawson, the biography of Harriet Tubman, will stay with us. You can be part of the conversation by sending an email to midday@wypr.org or phoning us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about Harriet Tubman with historian and Tubman expert Kate Clifford Lawson. Have you visited Harriet Tubman's museum, the local museum on the Eastern Shore, or have you traveled the Harriet Tubman Byway? What kind of effect did it have on you? Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Kate Clifford Lawson, I want to ask your particular point as we were closing out the first segment. You said people didn't know it was this petite little Harriet Tubman that was effectuating all of these escapes. And I'm confused about that, because didn't people sort of figure out when it was Harriet Tubman's family that was escaping? Didn't they figure it must be somebody at the heart of that family?
Actually, they didn't figure it out. And so if you can put yourself back into the 1850s, where women were very much second-class citizens, black women were even less than that, and a formerly enslaved black woman was really at the bottom of the chain of command of anything. And so these white slave owners could not imagine in their worldview that a black woman would be affecting these escapes. They just were not paying attention. And in fact, at one point, there were a lot of escapes going on, partly because of Tubman. And they worked themselves into a pretzel, the slave owners did, imagining that it was a white man dressed as a black woman who was helping all these people run away. I mean, you have to go through a lot of hoops to come up with that idea rather than just going right to it and saying, we think there's a black woman that's helping these people run away. Nope, it had to be a white man dressing as a black woman.
So that had to be a huge help to her in avoiding
Absolutely.
Detection.
Right, right.
Because she could be right in front of people and they wouldn't necessarily think that she had anything to do with this.
Right, they wouldn't notice her.
We got a call from Stephanie in Baltimore. Stephanie, welcome to Midday.
Hello, are you there?
Yes, and you're on the air.
Okay, I was calling to see, I've heard this reference that on the Underground Railroad, that quilts being positioned on porches or kinds of quilts are indicated some kind of way that it was a safe house or this was a way to go on the Underground Railroad. Can you tell me if any such markers were ever used?
Stephanie, I appreciate the question. Thank you. Kate Larson?
Well, I can tell you absolutely that no quilts were used. This is really plaguing historians these days because we know that children across the country are taught about this famous quilt code, where codes and secret messages were stitched into quilts that were hung outside for freedom seekers to look at and gather directions from. This is a myth that was created in the late 20th century during the 1990s, and it has no basis in fact or reality. And for anybody who lives in a rural area or go to the eastern shore of Maryland and go there at night where there are no streetlights and you can't see your hand in front of you, and for people to create these quilts that would take so long and with such detail and hang them outside so that someone would come at night and read them when you can't even see your hand in front of you. It just boggles my mind that this quilt code has promoted as a means of communication along the Underground Railroad. What I would like to do and other people, historians, would like to do is for people to think about the realities of escaping and the ingenuity that people used and the skills that they had in order to get away and the people that helped them. And they used their words, they communicated with each other, and they had other signals on the Underground Railroad, but they were not quilts, and that is a big myth, and I think a big lie that distorts the truth of the story of the Underground Railroad.
So tell us what kind of signals we know of.
We know that there were individual signals that certain people used in a very small area. Tubman used a coded letter to a free man in Dorchester County by the name of Jacob Jackson, and she wrote a code, had a letter written for her, and it referred to the old ship of Zion would be coming by and be ready to step aboard, and that was a message to her brothers that she was coming to rescue them.
So this is a letter
specific.
A letter she had sent after she herself had gotten to freedom.
That's right. That's right. So it's very specific to her. Tubman used one song that she sang in different tempos to indicate to her charges that it was safe to come out of hiding or that they had to stay hidden because it was dangerous. But that's very specific to Harriet Tubman. It was the song Bound for the Promised Land. And it can't be something that you can assume that everybody was using across the country. There were people who put, you know, did have, like they might have a something about their house that was particular to them that people would be sent. Like I know there's a house in Vermont that was on the Underground Railroad and it had a particular marking on its chimney. But that was one house. That doesn't mean every house that was on the Underground Railroad had this marking on a chimney. There are other stories about lawn jockeys that were used as signals on the Underground Railroad. That is totally false. That never happened. Those statues weren't even created until after the Civil War. So if you hear about a code, generally you just have to be very suspicious of codes and then think about its specificity to the place and to the people that were using it.
I want to review briefly the circumstances of Tubman's own escape. She and, what, two of her brothers had right. tried to escape, in at least the ad posted to for a small reward for, well, $100, I guess, wasn't small back then, but a reward that was dated early October 1849. And this was after she had reason to believe that she and her brothers might be sold south, right?
Right, and that was the impetus for them to flee because they knew that their mistress, Eliza Brodus, was going to sell them. So they fled, but they became confused and afraid of the path that they were taking. They weren't sure which way to go, which was happened frequently to people who were trying to escape. So they came back. But then Tubman
Do
knew
we know,
that she was going to...
Sorry to interrupt, but I'm so curious. Do we know if they were punished? I mean, were they gone long enough to be for their absence to be noted?
They were gone probably 3 weeks or so. So their absence was noted, and
of course, because there was an ad for a reward, yeah.
Right?
So what happened?
Tubman didn't say if they were punished, but she decided that she couldn't risk being sold because for people in the Upper South, to be sold to the deep South was like a death sentence, and she just couldn't bear to be taken away from her family, so she fled instead. And that
she
was
fled
very risky. Yeah,
she fled alone.
Very,
she didn't take her brothers on that first trip.
No,
and do we know from anything she said later? Did she see herself at that time of tapping into an underground railroad, or was she just setting out on her own?
She was tapping into an underground railroad. A white woman had approached her and told her that she would help her if she wanted help.
Ah.
And Tubman did approach that woman. We believe that she was a Quaker woman living in Caroline County at the time. And she followed the instructions from that woman to the next safe house, and they sent her to the next safe house until she finally reached Philadelphia.
So how do we know? And so she went all the way to Canada, correct?
She went to Philadelphia and she stayed there mostly until the 1850s. But the Fugitive Slave Act was passed in 1850, which made it very dangerous for freedom seekers to stay in the United States. And many of them went all the way to Canada to be safer. And she did take many of her charges all the way to Canada after 1851.
That is Kate Clifford Larson here on Midday on WIPR. She is author of Bound for the Promised Land, Harriet Tubman, Portrait of an American Hero. We are talking about Harriet Tubman, and you can be part of this conversation with an email to midday@wypr.org or call us at 410-662-8780. John has called us from Baltimore. John, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I understood that the manumission laws forbid freeing people when they were older. And I think 45 was pretty old at the time because it was a way of getting rid of the slaves because you couldn't get any more work out of them. And laws were passed that said you couldn't do this basically so the slaves could maybe stay on the plantation or be provided for by their family. And I think Thomas Jefferson in his younger years did something like this or had lobbied for this law like this to be passed because he thought it was basically protecting the slaves. It was just a way to get rid of older people. And do you have any comment on that?
Thanks for the question, John. Kate Clifford Larson?
Each state had its own laws that dealt with the construction of slavery and manumission. And in Maryland, they did pass a law that it was okay for slaveholders to manumit their enslaved people through the age of 45. So actually, many slaveholders waited until the enslaved person reached the age of 45. And they also did, you know, sort of shady things like telling someone that they were 45 when actually they were more like 55. But that was the law in Maryland, 45. Rick could have been liberated, but she wasn't.
So it was 45. I mean, were there many slave owners who issued those provisions that their that their slaves would be freed at that age?
Yes, there were some, and it was not unusual. The man that enslaved Harriet's father, Ben Ross, he died in the 1830s, and in his will, he set up a schedule so that all of his 43 enslaved people could be set free at specific dates into the future. Some of them were set free when they were 21 years old. Others were set free when they were 45. I'm not sure how he determined the ages, but he was like some other slaveholders who did that. And that contributed to a very large free black population in Maryland compared to other states.
Right. You write that when she married in 1844, about half the blacks in Dorchester County were free.
That's right. That's right. And she married a free man who had been born free of free parents. So there was a significant and stable free black community there.
I want to ask you about John Tubman, her husband, in a minute, but I feel like I'm understanding in a way that I haven't before. I think I'd always sort of assumed that in a place like, I'd heard it was true of Baltimore, I didn't know it was so true of Dorchester County, where there were so many freed blacks along with enslaved, that I think I assumed that slavery would be less oppressive for some reason because of the presence of so many free blacks. Yet when I read about Harriet Tubman's life as a teenager, especially really as a girl already, Araminta Ross, who became Harriet Tubman, she had a tough life.
Very tough. Very, very tough. You know, when people talk about, oh, slavery in the Upper South wasn't as bad as in the Deep South, slavery is slavery, and it was horrific and terrible no matter where it was. And the particular tragedy for the Upper South and, let's say, the Eastern Shore of Maryland, when there were so many free black families and free people, that meant that many of the families also had enslaved members. So they were caught in this strange world where some people were free to move about and some people were not. And also their enslaved family members were at risk every single day of being sold away and brutally treated, and the free family members could do nothing about it. So it was a terrible situation. It was, you know, not any easier for people living in the Upper South than in the Deep South.
Do you think that growing up among free blacks was part of Harriet Tubman's desire to escape?
I think every enslaved person, no matter where, wanted to be free. Tubman saw an opportunity, and she took it. And I think that she was lucky. There were many people who saw opportunities and took them and were not successful. And it's important to remind people of how difficult a decision it was to run away, because it meant that you'd have to leave behind everybody you loved, and they would miss you and you would miss them, and you risked getting caught and getting killed or sold away. So it was a very serious, complicated decision to make.
And even more impressive, I think, even more daunting, the decision to come back to free her family.
Right. And Tubman speaks to that. She arrived in Philadelphia, and she's nominally a free person. But it felt hollow to her because her family and the people that she loved were not with her. She was miserable. And that's how she determined she would go back and rescue as many people as possible. And the fact that she did it as many times as she did, it's still, I mean, I've been talking about this and researching it for 20 years, and it still amazes me what she did and how she did it and how successful she was.
It is breathtaking. I want to pick up on, you mentioned her husband, the name by which we know her, Tubman, is her husband's name. He was a free black man, as you said. He knew that in marrying an enslaved woman, his marriage would have no legal standing, that she could be sold away. If they had kids, they wouldn't be his. They wouldn't belong to him. Did very many free blacks marry enslaved spouses?
Yes, yes, they did, and that's what I was talking about earlier. These blended families of free and enslaved members in the same family. They married this way. On the Eastern Shore, most slaveholders did not force their enslaved people to marry someone of their choice. It was much more relaxed on the Eastern Shore, if that's the appropriate word to use. And so, you know, Tubman was free to marry whoever she wanted because for her master, any children she had would belong to him. So it didn't matter, you know, who she married as far as he was concerned. But the fact is that John Tubman must have deeply loved Harriet when they got married because he was giving up a lot to marry an enslaved woman.
Okay, maybe, but then she escapes. He's free. He could have picked up and gone with her at any point without risking what she risked. He never did.
Right. So I always feel like I have to defend John Tubman a little bit. I'm sure that they were hoping to raise enough money, to earn enough money to buy her freedom. But she picked up and left and didn't come back for 2 years. And he was a free man, free family. He had a life there. He probably just did not want to leave that behind. He wasn't strong enough. He wasn't willing to do that. But she abandoned the marriage as far as he's concerned. I'm sure that's what he felt. So he married a free woman the next time, a woman by the name of Caroline, and they had 4 children together. It broke Harriet Tubman's heart, though, that he left her. He abandoned the marriage when she thought that he would be willing to come north eventually. But he wasn't. He loved his life there. He was free.
That is so sad. We need to take another break. There's lots more to talk about with Kate Clifford Larson, the biographer of Harriet Tubman, including what's going to be going on this weekend at the Harriet Tubman Conference. You can be part of this conversation. What would you like to know about Harriet Tubman? This is a great chance to ask someone who knows a great deal. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about Harriet Tubman, or Moses, as some call her, with her biographer, Kate Clifford Larson. Kate, I want to ask you, before the time completely gets away from us, about the movie that's being made from your book, Bound for the Promised Land, Harriet Tubman, Portrait of an American Hero. HBO is making a movie, correct?
That's right, starring Viola Davis. I'm excited and thrilled, and the scriptwriter is Kirk Ellis, who did the John Adams HBO series a few years back, and think he's brilliant. Yeah, and he's doing a great job.
And so, tell us what the timeline is. When can we see this movie?
So, from what I understand, Viola will be filming next spring, early summer, when she's on break from her series on ABC. How to Get Away with Murder. And then I assume it's going to be sometime in early 2018 that the film will come out.
Would you expect some of this filming to be taking place on the Eastern Shore?
I hope so, but I have no say, so
I understand.
I wish I did, but I don't.
I understand. It's in their hands now. Ted is calling us from Baltimore. Ted, welcome to Midday. Ted? Maybe Ted will call us back or figure out his phone. We sort of mentioned in passing some of the kinds of skills that Harriet Tubman would have needed to have to do what she did, navigating waterways. Where did that come from? Where did she pick up those kinds of skills?
Harriet learned a tremendous amount of skills from her father, first and foremost, certainly her mother as well. But her father taught her survival skills in the woods. When she was a teenager and young adult, after she suffered that horrific head injury.
We haven't actually talked about the head injury. Tell us briefly about that.
When she was about 13 years old, she was hit in the head with an iron weight from a dry goods store counter, and an overseer threw it, hoping to hit another slave, but hit Tubman instead, and it nearly killed her. It crushed her skull and left her with epileptic seizures for the rest of her life. But after she recovered from that as a young teenager, she became quite strong, and she was allowed to work in the woods with her father, who was an expert lumberjack and timber inspector. And she learned how to survive there and navigate the woods and the marshes and the waterways. She was a brilliant person. She was a genius, as far as I'm concerned. And she learned and retained everything that she experienced. And that helped her survive those many days on the Underground Railroad. She knew how to listen and pay attention and trust her instincts so that she could change her path and any decision that she had made very, very quickly in order to make sure that she didn't get caught. Just amazing skills that helped her survive. And, you know, foraging in the forest and how to cross fields and deal with barking dogs and slave catchers and trying to get away from them. She just was very, very clever, very clever.
There are stories that she carried a firearm to bolster the courage of slaves that she was ferrying toward freedom if they lost their nerve. Is that a myth, or is there truth to that?
Well, I think that she carried a pistol, by the way, not a rifle or a shotgun. She carried a pistol mostly as protection from slave catchers, but we do know of one instance where she did pull the pistol on a young man who felt he couldn't go on and that he wanted to return, and she apparently said to him, "Go on or die," and he picked himself up and followed her. I don't think that she would have ever used it personally against another enslaved person, but she didn't want to risk him betraying them, so she threatened him and he fell into line.
Tough choices. I'm gonna skip ahead because I do want people to be aware of this, and I think many of us aren't very aware of her period in the Union Army. This is after she'd been free for a decade or more. She'd lived in Canada. She'd moved, I guess, already to Auburn, New York. She'd freed many of her family, including her parents. How did she come to be in the Union Army?
The governor of Massachusetts at the time, who was so impressed with her skills at going back and forth into Maryland undetected. She had connections everywhere. She got along with people. She was a remarkable human being, and he was so impressed with her, he asked her to please go to South Carolina, where the Union Army had taken a foothold, and see if she could help them with spying. So she arrived down there in Port Royal, Hilton Head District, and she started doing scouting and spy work for the generals down there, and she was remarkably successful. She was, even just saying that again, I can't believe the things that she pulled off and did as this 5-foot-tall little petite woman. But she was willing to continue her battle, her war against slavery, right onto the battlefield.
You write, she alternated her roles as nurse and scout, cook and spy in the service of the Union Army. And eventually she became the first American woman ever to lead an armed raid into enemy territory.
That's right.
This is remarkable for anybody with any kind of background.
That's right. And it also speaks to some of the Union officers who respected her tremendously. And she had access to their offices and to, you know, speak to them anytime that she wanted to. They really were so impressed by her, and she was so well respected. And she worked with Colonel James Montgomery, who had been who had worked with John Brown. And she did spy work for him and helped him on a Combi River raid where they routed out some rebel forces and liberated 750 enslaved people. It was a great raid, and it was touted in the newspaper at the time that this black Shemoses had led the raid.
And yet she had trouble getting a pension from
That's right.
from her military service. How did that work out?
Eventually, she did get a pension as the widow of a Civil War soldier. She remarried later in life to a young man who was 22 years younger than she was, by the way, and who had fought in the Civil War. So she got his pension, and then they awarded her a $12 a month pension as a Civil War nurse. But she never got paid as a spy and a scout like men did. And when I went through the records, I discovered that there were African-American spies and scouts who were paid. And it wasn't because of her race that she was not paid. It was because she was a woman.
Which leads me to ask you about her work for suffrage, for women's suffrage.
She spent the last half of her life campaigning for the rights for women to vote. And I can't imagine that feeling that she must have had when her brothers got the right to vote in the late 1860s, but she did not. And after all the work that she had done, she still could not vote. It just must have been so bitter for her. But she kept campaigning, and unfortunately she died in 1913, 7 years before women got the right to vote.
Tell me more about what role she played. There were meetings of women fighting for suffrage. Was she in the middle of that? Was that a well racially integrated movement?
It was not a well integrated movement, unfortunately. Many of the white women that were involved in the movement were racist, and they did not care whether black women got the right to vote or not. Susan B. Anthony was very close to Tubman, and she did campaign and welcomed integrated meetings. And Tubman did speak about women's suffrage. She did go to conventions and had a place on some of the convention floors. So she was well known, and she did advocate. And it's unfortunate she didn't get to vote before she died.
It may be in your book, and it also just may be something I read elsewhere that's not well documented. But someplace I read that when she went to some of the gatherings, she knew she wouldn't be able to stay in a hotel. She would arrive and wait out the night in the train station, knowing
that's
that as a black she wasn't allowed in the hotel, but still wanting to be part of that work.
She absolutely did that. Yes, yeah. And she sold some of her farm animals to earn the money to be able to pay a train ticket to get to some of these suffrage meetings.
You write about that she knew John Brown of the raid on Harper's Ferry. She helped plan that raid, correct?
She helped support John Brown. She recruited men in Canada for his provisional army that he was hoping to take to down south to start this war. But she ended up not being there when he conducted the raid. Fortunately for her.
Because everybody on his crew was arrested and executed
killed, hanged, for
treason,
right.
But she would have been willing to be part of that. Is your impression?
That's right. She was willing to be part of it. When it came down to the final days, I'm not sure if she decided it was probably not going to work out. I don't know. She was missing in action. Basically, she did not show up for the raid.
We have another call. It's obscured right now, but I think I can get to it in a minute. Someone is calling us, Janet from Pikesville. Janet, welcome to Midday.
Hello. A couple weeks ago, the PBS stations played the entire TV series about Harriet Tubman's life. I forget what the title was. But it starred Cicely Tyson, and does your guest think that was an accurate portrayal of her life?
Janet, thank you for the question. Kate Clifford Larson?
It is not an accurate portrayal of Harriet Tubman's life. That was based on a book written in the 1970s called A Woman Called Moses, and it's fiction. It's a work of fiction. It is not true, and it has a lot of stereotypes in it that are not accurate. Cicely Tyson, I thought, is brilliant in that film, but the story itself is deeply, deeply flawed, unfortunately.
Janet, I appreciate your raising that. I wanted to ask you, Kate Clifford Larson, about about Harriet Tubman's spirituality. You quote Thomas Garrett, who was a famous Underground Railroad agent, about Tubman. He said he never met any person of any color who had more confidence in the voice of God as spoken direct to her soul, and her faith in a supreme power truly was great, close quote. What do we know of her spirituality?
What I know and have come to understand about Tubman and her spirituality is that it was deeply personal. And it wasn't necessarily, particularly in the early part of her life, rooted in any particular church building or particular faith community, because different masters that she was hired to attended different churches, and some were Methodist, Episcopal, some were Baptist, Catholic, etc. But I think she just felt a deep spiritual presence around her that just filled her with faith and confidence in God. And that guided her most of her life. She, you know, became a member of different churches throughout her later life, and eventually settled into the AME Zion Church in Auburn, New York. But it was always deeply personal for her, very deeply personal. She didn't need a church building for her to feel her faith and to practice her faith.
Kate Clifford Larson, we are down to just a minute, and I haven't asked you about the conference this weekend in Cambridge, right? Tell me what you're going to be talking about.
I'm going to be talking about particular escapes from the East New Market area that were linked, or we believed are linked, to a man, a free black man by the name of Samuel Green. The conference is great. There's 2 days of workshops and keynote speakers and a dinner and lunch, and it's scholars and local people and artists that are all coming together to talk about their research and their work on Harriet Tubman and the Underground Railroad and all these stories that we are just beginning to uncover.
What do you most want people to know about Harriet Tubman in just a sentence or two? What is it that we should understand?
That she was a very ordinary person who did extraordinary things, and it was because of her intense love for her family, her profound faith, her desperate need for freedom and equality and justice and self-determination, and that drove her to do the things that she did. And so for me, when I title my book American Hero, I mean that, because I think we all hold those values dear, but here's a woman who had virtually nothing, who practiced that and pushed for it and demanded it and valued those things that we value, and we value those in American heroes. And I think she's even better than the Paul Revere's of the world.
I am very grateful for this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kate Clifford Larson is author of Bound for the Promised Land, Harriet Tubman, Portrait of an American Hero. She's the consulting historian for both a state park and a byway dedicated to Tubman on the Eastern Shore. She'll be presenting at the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Conference in Cambridge this weekend. I also want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. By 2050, the number of Americans with Alzheimer's disease is projected to triple to 14 million. What can be done to screen more Americans? How does the stigma of dementia affect individuals and their loved ones? I'm Sheila Cass. That's tomorrow. Stay with us on 88.1. Here and Now is next.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.